So reading from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 7, verse 1 through 5, it's on page 6 of your pew Bible. Do not judge so that you may not be judged, for the judgment will make you be judged, and the measure you give will be the measure you get. Why do you see the speck in your neighbor's eye, but do not notice the log in your own eye? Or how can you say to your neighbor, let me take the speck out of your eye, while the log is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your neighbor's eye. Amen.
Last Wednesday in Department 10 of the Alameda County Superior Court, 11 other jurors and I sent a 26-year-old man to prison for the rest of his life. My summons to report for jury duty was for February 18th, the day after Ash Wednesday. Closing arguments, after we heard all of the testimony and saw all of the evidence that was being presented, were exactly 6 weeks later on Maundy Thursday. Now, I had always been under the illusion that we get to choose our own Lenten spiritual practice, with some discernment, of course, to ask for guidance from God on what it is that we need to be working on spiritually, what we should focus on during those 6 weeks. But basically, I always assumed it was up to me, that I would spend half an hour every morning in prayer, or that I would give up chocolate, or that I would work on my anger issues. But apparently, sometimes your Lenten discipline is chosen for you. Whether that choice was made by God or by the County of Alameda, I'm not quite sure, but the liturgical timing is definitely suspect. I couldn't talk about it while it was going on. We were reminded of that every night when we finished hearing evidence and testimony. And that was hard. That was really hard. Partly because we were going to some pretty dark places in the testimony, and we had no opportunity to process that with anyone. In the admonition, it includes not even your therapist or spiritual advisor. So I and all the others had to find other ways to deal with the darkness and with the emotional and psychological stress of the things that we were hearing. But secondly, it was an amazing trial. It was so important in its connection to the story of Oakland, and there were some wonderfully compelling moments, great rhetoric and twisted humor, and I love talking about that kind of stuff, and I was not allowed to. So finally, as of Wednesday, I get to talk about it at last. So I'm going to do that today. I'm not sure this even counts as a sermon. We'll see at the end. But I want to, first of all, to tell the story of the trial itself, because it was a complicated one, and people keep asking me what it was about if they weren't reading the newspaper stories as it was going on. This will be a severely abbreviated telling of the story of 5.5 weeks of testimony. And I also want to talk a little bit about some of my experience of the trial, particularly the deliberations process, and to do a bit of theological reflection on the whole experience. So first of all, the trial itself. The defendant's name is Richard Lewis. He had 6 felony charges against him: kidnapping, kidnapping with intent to commit robbery, kidnapping for the purpose of extortion, 2 counts of carjacking, and torture. To tell this story, I need to give you a little bit of background on the events leading up to this event itself. And some of these things I already knew just from being a resident of this part of the world. Some I learned in the course of the trial, and some I learned when I was done and could finally Google this stuff. The whole story has to do with Your Black Muslim Bakery, which is kind of an institution in Oakland, sometimes for better and sometimes for worse. The bakery was founded in the late 1960s by Dr. Yusuf Bey. It was a spin-off of sorts from the Nation of Islam movement of Elijah Muhammad, but not formally connected with the Oakland Nation of Islam mosques. It was a spiritual organization, in part, where the teachings of Elijah Muhammad were promulgated, where Dr. Bey spoke out, gave spiritual training and instruction to the members of the bakery, also speaking out against racism and white supremacy in the United States and in Oakland. He challenged police brutality and abuse of power, particularly in the Oakland Police Department's dealing with African-American people. It was a place where young African-American men just out of prison were invited to come, a place where they could live, have a job, some discipline, and some spiritual grounding. It was also a place where much of the business was conducted with a semi-military style structure and system of authority, and where the orders of the leader were obeyed without question. In time, over the years, Dr. Bey wielded a great deal of political influence in Oakland, and there were many complaints over the years that people in power were turning a blind eye to the allegations of criminal activity emanating from the bakery, everything from health department violations to rape, torture, and murder. Dr. Bey died of cancer in 2003, I believe, with some charges, legal charges lodged against him that were never resolved. Dr. Bey left behind him 42 children. As he was dying, he named his successor, a man named Wajid, who took the last name Bey in honor of Dr. Bey, but was not a biological or legal member of the family. Wajid had been a trusted financial advisor to Dr. Bey in running the bakery and its businesses and was part of the old guard there. 5 months after he took up the reins, he disappeared. His place at the helm was assumed by Dr. Bey's son, Antar, who I believe was 23 when he assumed leadership of the bakery and obviously was part of the next generation of Dr. Bey's children. In July of 2004, Wajid's body was discovered in a shallow grave in the Oakland Hills, obviously murdered. A few months later, Antar himself was shot to death in an apparent bungled carjacking, again leaving a vacancy at the head of the bakery. Another son, then Yusuf Bey IV, and it took me a while to figure out that all of these numbers, there's a Yusuf Bey Jr., Yusuf Bey III, the fourth, and the fifth, they are all of the same generation, just named after their father in succession. Yusuf Bey IV took over as CEO after Antar was killed. And he also, I think, was 22 or 23 at the time. And immediately things began to fall apart. They were starting to already, but this was a sudden shift in life at the bakery. Employees, members of the bakery community left in droves. The older generation, the leaders and mentors, took off. Financial problems surfaced, serious financial problems. It was learned that Antar had taken out a $600,000 loan against the bakery, and no one knew where that money had gone, but it had not been paid back, and the bakery now was deep in debt. There also were unpaid taxes, which were mounting in amounts of several hundred thousand dollars. So the bakery outlets in 17th Street in Oakland, at the Coliseum, and at the airport were closing down. The security contract that they had, there was a security service that was a side business operated out of the bakery. Their main contract was at the Marriott in the Oakland Convention Center, and that contract was taken away and awarded to one of the disaffected Bey brothers. Several journalists, including Chauncey Bailey, the editor of the Oakland Post, were starting to investigate goings-on at the bakery, and they were feeling the pressure. So by May 2007, which is the time when the crimes that I was responsible for making a judgment on took place, they were in desperate times. They were imminently facing bankruptcy. The owner of the building was going to be free to foreclose any time after May 21st. The family was disintegrating. Pressure from the police and from journalists was mounting. So they decided to take desperate action. They needed a huge infusion of cash to keep from losing the bakery, to keep from losing everything that Dr. Bey had built up. So Yusuf Bey IV came up with a plan, and this is alleged. He has not been tried for this yet, although he will be. He decided that what they should do would be to rob some drug dealers and to use the cash obtained in those robberies to pay off some of the debts, which were now approaching $1 million. So they contacted an underworld figure who was a known drug dealer in the community and whom they several of them knew at the bakery knew socially, and asked who they should rob. Did any of you watch The Wire? Omar, who robbed drug dealers, this was kind of along those lines. So this underworld figure named a man who was another local drug dealer and was his competition, was as someone they could go and get some large amount of cash from, and then also identified a woman drug dealer whom that competitor supplied with the drugs that she needed. He told them where they could find this woman one evening. She was going to be playing bingo at a bingo parlor and was there with her elderly mother, who was schizophrenic. 5 bakery members in 2 cars, including one which was an unmarked decommissioned police cruiser, Crown Victoria, that they used in their security business, went out, watched this woman's car. When she came out with her mother, they followed her up onto the freeway, and then the Crown Victoria pulled in behind her, turned on its flashing lights, pulled her over as though they were police, kidnapped her and her mother at gunpoint, put them into the back seat of the Crown Victoria, put handcuffs on the younger woman and a black plastic garbage bag over her head so she could not see what was going on, stuck a gun in her ribs, covered her mother's head as well with a jacket, took all 3 cars, now drove them down to an abandoned home in East Oakland, where they proceeded to take the younger woman inside to beat and torture her in order to force her to say where her supplier was and where her money was, and threatened to kill her. Meanwhile, an officer of the Oakland Police Department was patrolling the neighborhood just on regular patrol. And as he drove down the street where this house was, he noticed, completely unrelated to what was going on inside this house or to the cars that were parked in front of this house, noticed a car parked along the street that had been reported stolen. So he went to do a U-turn, to go back, to radio in that he had found this stolen car. As he turned his U-turn, his lights shone upon the house where this woman was being held. One of the perpetrators looked out the window and saw a police car pulling up and took off running. The others took off after him. They ran to the back of the house, tried to throw a window open, but it was locked, so they smashed the window and ran and jumped out. The policeman, who's turning around out in front of the street, suddenly hears the sound of breaking glass and people hitting fences, as he called it, jumping the fences into backyards. Our victim, sitting there, still handcuffed and with the trash bag over her head, hears her assailants flee. She starts screaming at the top of her lungs for help. She managed to stumble her way out the front door, where a very confused Oakland police officer is standing. She is hysterical and covered in blood. And he tries to comfort her and radios for an ambulance and for additional police support. The victim, when she testified before us in the early days of the trial, called him her guardian angel and said if it weren't for him, she would be dead. And she brings him flowers and cookies at the police station. So this is how I spent my Lenten season, immersed in this story. And this is only the most basic outline of the story. It was much more complicated, much more sorrowful, much more frightening, and much more fascinating than I have been able to communicate in these few minutes. And as I said some weeks ago when this first started, there are at least 6 sermons that I would love to preach on this whole issue. and the things, the theological questions that it raises, abuse of power and its corrupting influence, brother turning against brother, because two of the Bey brothers have now turned state's evidence and are testifying against Yusuf Bey IV and testified against Richard Lewis, the defendant in this trial, making plea bargains and speaking out against each other in court. Lots of biblical precedent for brother turning against brother. But today, for just a few minutes, I want to talk about the act of judging someone. When several hundred of us were in the original jury pool, we were all given questionnaires to fill out. And one of the questions that was asked was, are you able to pass judgment on another person? And the reference I felt was to that passage in Matthew where it says, do not judge, lest you be judged. And so a lot of people would say, well, I can't judge another person. The Bible says I shouldn't judge another person. But that's not what that text really says. It says, do not judge unless you are willing to be judged by the same standard. If, you know, take the speck out of your own eye so that you, before you tell someone else to take the log out of theirs, that it has to do with integrity and with a willingness to be held accountable in the same way that we tend to want to hold other people accountable. That it's, there's a mutuality in it rather than a prohibition. It doesn't say don't judge. It says just do so with integrity and not with hypocrisy. And our judge, Judge Reardon, as when he was giving asking questions of all the potential jurors and talking to us about this, he said, you are not judging the person. You are not judging their value as a human being or a child of God, he said, in real life right there in the courtroom. He said, you are judging their actions. You are judging whether they did the things that they are accused of doing. And that's good theology. I'm okay with that. We are not judging their value as a human being. God is the one who gives us value as human beings. We are judging actions and we are holding people accountable. And I believe in accountability. One of the most meaningful parts of this experience had to do with the jury itself. That experience of serving on a jury, and many of you have told me this from your own jury experiences, how meaningful it was. How hard people worked. And it's a very Presbyterian thing to get 12 people together to talk about stuff. But you can get biblical even before that. Back in the scriptures, in the Old Testament, the Ten Commandments are given in the book of Exodus. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, honor thy father and mother, remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. So that's about two paragraphs in Exodus, where it talks about how now that we are forming as a community of faith, a community following God, how do we treat each other in this community for the good of all and in order to honor God? So you've got those Ten Commandments there in Exodus. And then the rest of Exodus and Deuteronomy and Leviticus are all about what you do when people fail to keep the commandments, not if. When people break those commandments, how does the community then correct itself? Because that's what's going to happen. How do we correct the members of the community when things go off track? And in our legal system, the system of democracy and government that we have here, we operate under the rule of law. We are governed by a system of laws. Everyone, even the government itself, is governed by a system of laws. There are courts where the laws are applied. We have judges and lawyers. We have experts on DNA. We have hours of testimony. We have piles of evidence. But when it gets down to it, it's up to 12 people from all walks of life with no training for this particular job except maybe a civics class in high school and our own life experiences. We sit down in a room together and we talk. We represent the community. We represent the society that has a vested interest in this process being applied well. So with this jury, obviously, we're not allowed to talk to each other about the trial, about any of the evidence that's been presented, until all of the evidence has been presented. We're not supposed to start you know, deliberating until the whole, until the lawyers have had their chances to present all the evidence to us so we have the full picture in front of us. So that's really hard to do because we were together a lot and we played dominoes and we made jigsaw puzzles and we got to know each other really, really well. We had a potluck every Thursday where we would bring our little stuff through the metal detector downstairs and have these wonderful meals together, and so that we knew each other pretty well by the time we got around to deliberating. We didn't know each other's opinions about the case because we couldn't talk about that, but we knew each other as people, families and jobs and what the best restaurants are in town. So on Maundy Thursday, we heard the closing arguments from both of the attorneys and about an hour of instruction from the judge, and about 4:15 we went upstairs. We finish at 4:30. And the judge said, go upstairs. You can choose your foreperson if you want and come back on Monday morning at 9:30, ready to deliberate. Monday morning, 9:30 being the day after Easter. So we went upstairs. Someone said, should we choose a foreman? Everyone said, sure, foreperson. And I got the job. I'm just a girl who can't say no. Basically, I was just remembered Chandler's mother one time said, never go to a meeting that you don't run. I don't agree with that 100%, but in this case, I was down with that. So as we were about to leave that Thursday afternoon, and the foreperson had been elected, and one of the women on the jury said, and the first thing we should do Monday morning is just take a straw poll and kind of see where everybody is on this. So and then we walked out. So I spent the weekend, when I had a minute, thinking about that, about taking a straw poll when we first got together, and I thought, that's not a good idea. For one thing, there was nothing conclusive in the evidence that was presented. There was no literal or figurative smoking gun. There were arguments for guilt, arguments for not guilty. You could weigh them various ways. You could tilt either way. I thought, if we take a vote right away, we're basically voting on which lawyer did a better job. And that's not our job. It could be polarizing, people could get defensive and then have to feel like they had to defend a stance that they had taken in the straw poll, even if it were a secret ballot. But when we got back together and we were talking about that, I was saying our job is to weigh the evidence and to keep the discussion as open as we possibly can, hold it open as forcefully as we need to, so that all of us are free to examine everything we've heard and seen from every possible angle without feeling pressured to represent a particular point of view. Because it's all about reasonable doubt. What we had been instructed is that the prosecuting attorney, the assistant DA's job was to convince us beyond a reasonable doubt that these crimes had been committed and this man was there. And if he did not do that job, we exonerate the guy. So it's all about reasonable doubt. And I love that phrase anyway. That has some great theological implications that you could chase after for a while. But our job was to decide. It was an abiding conviction of guilt. That was the wording in our instructions. Not just today, but we could wake up tomorrow, we could wake up the next day, we could wake up the next day thinking we made the right decision. I made the right decision. So, that holding the discussion open, holding back the pressure to decide or to be defensive or something, that's also a really good Presbyterian concept where everything is done by committee. The Holy Spirit works in groups and helps us in our discernment process, that when people talk together openly and honestly, we come to a closer approximation of the will of God than one person with too much authority and perhaps too many vested interests would be able to do on their own. And that's what we did. We tore that evidence apart for hours and hours and hours. We got to the end of the first day and we were exhausted. And I was a little discouraged because the work was so hard. But the people did a great job. The next morning we showed up, we did it some more. We tore things apart for hours and hours and hours. And this was just to say, was he there or not? This wasn't even looking at the six counts that were against him yet. So another part of the job that I had or assumed was that I did my best to create space for the emotional dimension of the work that we were doing, because this is really hard. We would pause at times if I could see someone tearing up or if I could see someone just getting exhausted, we'd stop and check in, remind each other that the young man's future we held in our hands, to feel compassion for him, to feel compassion for the victim, for the two Bay brothers who had testified in front of us, especially young Joshua, who was 18 when the crime was committed, who had some developmental or cognitive deficit, disability of some sort, I'm not sure what, raised in this weird cultish family, and who just wanted to be loyal to his big brothers and do what they said, and found himself caught up in this terrible mess and facing life in prison without parole. And now here he is testifying against Richard Lewis and soon to testify against his big brother, Yusuf Bey IV. So there was a lot of emotional work that went on too. But by the end of the second day, we had found him guilty of 5 of the 6 counts and had one more to discuss. But the 6th was the most complicated one in terms of legal things that we had to agree to. So we decided just to go home and save it for the next day. So when we arrived that third morning, I could see this pain and stress on people's faces as we showed up and poured our coffee. And I thought, we shouldn't just jump into the task of saying, okay, one last charge, let's get to work. So I said, let's talk. You've all slept on it now. We had to vote guilty, 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 5 times already. We did hard work yesterday, and it was painful. And are you all okay? And we started talking about that. And I said, do we need to revisit anything? Do you want to change your vote? Have you changed your mind? Because we need to do that now. So we just talked for about 20 minutes just about what it felt like to have taken all those votes the day before and how we were feeling. But it was really clear that everyone was confident in their decisions, but that it was still really hard and really sad. There are a lot of ruined lives in this story. So we discussed for another hour or so, and we voted on the final count, voted guilty once again, and took a break to decompress. Once you have the verdicts all done, you buzz the little buzzer 3 times to tell the people down in the courtroom downstairs that you've come to, that we've reached a verdict. It's kind of like the white smoke when the Pope is elected. And we really waited before we pushed that button 3 times. People are like, oh God, not yet, not yet. Because it's, you know, you're going to go down there and tell this guy what you just decided. So as we were there, I said, well, there's one other thing we should talk about, which is that they can poll us individually. The defense attorney can have us each say what our vote was. And if he wants to, he can have each of us say it for all 6 counts. We could have to say the word guilty 72 times when we go down there. And a couple of people are like, oh, my God. But I said, we just need to be ready for that. We need to be emotionally ready for that. We need to be confident in what we're saying. And one woman said, yeah, a friend of mine was in a civil trial, and when they polled the jury, 2 of them changed their votes. And they declared a mistrial and went back to square one. So we're like, oh, my God. So I said, if we're going to do that, let's do that now. We need to be confident when we go downstairs and in that place to be able to say, yes, that was our vote. So we talked about that a little bit more. And then we buzzed 3 times. And then they buzzed 2 times, which means line up according to your numbers and parade on down. The bailiff will unlock the doors and you can go down into the courtroom. So we headed downstairs. I had my 6 little verdict forms in my hands. And juror number 9, who was right behind me as we headed downstairs, put her hand on my shoulder and said, thank you, you did a good job. And I said, thanks, you did too. And we did. It's the way it's supposed to be done, I think. Collective wisdom, multiple diverse voices and experiences all weighing in on these intense and important questions. But we were all serious, we were all compassionate, and we were all committed to a just and a civilized society. Amen.